You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
All right. Well, it is 4 o'clock. And you are creating a funny characters panel. My name is Matthew Buck, and I am the host of Rest Negotiations, Star Wars Podcast, as well as 602 Club. And I'm really excited to be here. This may be the most nervous I'll be all weekend because this is an amazing lineup. And you're going to be talking about creating iconic characters. And so first, I wanted to have the panel please introduce yourself and allow them to know some of the iconic franchises and or characters that you have gotten to work on so they have an idea of what you've gotten to do.
You start with me?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Henry Gilroy. I write a lot of animation. I've worked, from everywhere, from Warner Brothers on Batman the Animated Series all the way up through Justice League and Timon and Pumbaa for Disney and Lilo and Stitch and Kim Possible, as well as the animated Clone Wars series, the CG series. I co-created Ahsoka Tano and Captain Rex. I was there for a few years. I also worked on G.I. Joe Renegades, Ultimate Spider-Man, Hulk and the Agents of Smash, Avengers, and most recently Star Wars Rebels.
For which he in Rebels Season 4 are up for an Emmy, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Thank you. Yes. Timothy Zahn, I just write books. Created a couple of characters back in the 90s, added a few more nowadays. I think lovingly borrowed, I'm very pleased with how Rebels dealt with Grand Admiral Thrawn and such. Yes. Thank you.
Hi, Rob Alsop. I kind of glue things together usually. I've worked on various films making costumes of lead characters like Dredd. I'm a sort of specialist costumer, so I'll get asked to do a particular character for a film, maybe for, like we did one for Thor 2 that was a big armoured guy. Anything a bit kind of more like a prop than a costume is my kind of thing. So like spacesuits for the Martian or bits of Gladiator. Quite a lot of Ridley Scott films is what I've been mostly doing the last kind of 30 years, really.
That's cool. My name is Fawn Davis. I've been working in motion pictures and television on the special effects side mostly. For 30 years this year. And I've worked on over 30 feature films, like the Star Wars series, Matrix series, Jurassic Park series, and Terminator series, little indie things, you know. and now I run a production studio in Los Angeles, and we do everything from design, sets, characters, environments, and robots, a lot of robots, through fabricating them and then doing photography.
My name is E.K. Johnston, and I am a writer. I wrote Star Wars Ahsoka and the forthcoming Star Wars Queen's Shadow, which is about Padme Amidala and her handmaidens.
So I wanted to ask you guys, when you were first hired to work on one of these franchises, and what is the first step in creating these characters from your specific arena?
From writing, the Star Wars, or even any of the superhero stuff, you're drawing on a lot of prehistory. So everyone has expectations for what Spider-Man should look like, or Batman, or even, you know, an armored character and a pre-established, as well as like the effects or robots. But for me, something special about Star Wars specifically was it was kind of like the first mythology that was sort of defined in film. It came from cinema. And I think when you look at what inspired it was a lot of movies that were samurai films combined with the Western and the old 30s science fiction series. So when I go back, I really kind of think about, what's sort of a pulpy style character that kind of draws from cinema that I can combine. And then, you know, I leave it up to our costumer, you know, and our effects guy to actually figure out how to make it. So when I write the phrase like, you know, the gladiator shows up in bitchin' armor, it takes me 1 second to type that in that 6 months of his life. So thank you, Robert.
Yeah, I think the key is, as Henry says, you've got to have something that fits into the atmosphere, the feel of what you're doing. So you want it to feel like this person could be just off camera in a Star Wars movie, would walk past and not be a glaring distraction to people. So that's, you start by understanding the feel of how this thing works, whether it's, you know, Star Wars, Terminator, or something else, and then construct your characters that way.
From my point of view, usually there's a drawing of, or a design of some sort that I'm working to for a costume. It could be, if it's on a big like Marvel film or something like that, it could be something that's virtually photorealistic that they expect to be reproduced in every detail, or on a more, but much more low budget film like Dread, it could be just a rough pencil sketch that I'd be elaborating on and collaborating with the designer to kind of refine the look. Or even sometimes on some of the Doctor Who's I've worked on, I've been given pretty much free rein to do sketches myself and then get those approved by the costume designer. So it can be anything from a rough pencil sketch as a starting point to a photorealistic piece of artwork. But even on I think one film, I think it was 47 Ronin, there was a character I was given all these kind of CG renderings of that I was looking at thinking, so has someone actually built this already? Because these look so realistic. So it can vary hugely.
That's funny. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's anything from a napkin to a 3D computer model. but yeah, the same thing. I mean, we do a lot of, when we do our character work, we do a lot of immersion. So if it's a subject matter like Star Wars, we'll dig into a lot of Star Wars books. And luckily, I'm very familiar with that growing up a fan of the series myself. But in other series, yeah, you dig into whatever the mythology has already been created, as well as what that mythology has been inspired from. You know, so we have a full library at our studio of reference books. Maybe these things are inspired by insects or mammals or, you know, robots or whatever. And robots from genre to genre are very, very different. But most of all, the one thing that we always, always focus on is storytelling. So even if you're just doing something as simple as a robot, you try to tell a story about the robot with the paint job. You know, like in the world of Star Wars, everything is very, very dirty and used because it's a very practical universe, you know. If we're working on a Star Trek movie, everything would be very clean because, you know, the Federation has standards.
They got money.
You know, so it's exactly that. It's just, you know, it's always goes back to the storytelling.
What I've done so far is primarily character expansion over character creation. I've created the side characters, which I hope become iconic eventually. But with Ahsoka and with Padme and the Handmaidens, I've kind of got to go back into a character that I know a little bit about, or that we know 5 seasons worth in Ahsoka's case, and sort of flush out what goes on off screen, which was also very fun.
That's something that brings to mind this idea of what inspires you then when you're either creating a new character or you are working on something that already is iconic and you're adding to that. Where does that inspiration then come from?
If it's already been created, it's, I think, faithful representation. So that there is something that goes, wow, that's kind of, if it came from a book, that's exactly what I expect Thrawn to look like or have him to behave. And when it's already appeared in like a different media, like let's say film, and it's coming to animation, I think is bringing it to the new medium. And out of books is the same thing, bringing it to a new medium, but still giving it all of the characteristics that makes it what it is.
Yeah, basically that working with Padme and Thrawn alliances, I thought the character was kind of wasted in the prequels, but they flesh out really wonderfully in the Clone Wars. So with Padme, she can, you know, shoot, she can fight, but she can also be a diplomat. So she, when I put her in a particular situation, it was a question of, okay, this is Padme. Which tool will she pull from her toolbox to deal with this problem? And I think that helps make the character, okay, yeah, that's exactly what Padme would do in this situation.
Before answering the question, it just occurs to me, I worked with Padme as well, because I was doing the wireframes to do her big hairstyles in Phantom Menace. So three of us on the panel worked on the same character.
Priya's going to have some follow-up questions in a second. Brace yourself.
But to answer the question, the inspiration usually will come from the costume designer and either their drawing or their enthusiasm and vision of what the character is going to be. Or sometimes if it's a character with a history that goes back over many years, like something that's a recurring character from a series, it can come from the history of that character. And it could be that I'm in a situation, as has happened on Doctor Who, that I'm more familiar with the past history of a character or a group of characters than the person actually designing them. So that can be quite helpful to have a bit of input as well and try and respect what's been done previously and update that and adapt it to work better with a modern audience.
Yeah, for us, if we're dealing with an established character, of course, it always starts with research. And like I was saying before, immersion. Luckily for us, a lot of the companies that we work for have pretty good archives of photographs and things like that. So we'll dig into all the photographs, try to get as many measurements. Sometimes we get a hold of the original molds or even some of the original prop or costume pieces for characters. Sometimes it is something as simple as restoring. When we did the Star Wars Special Editions, that was the easiest costuming we'd ever done because it was all already done. We just had to fix it. But they were done in like the 70s and 80s, so they were falling apart.
For me, I used to think it was weird, like, because people would be like, what's your inspiration for writing Star Wars? I'd be like, Star Wars? But so much of the Star Wars inspiration is cyclical. Like, it comes from that tradition of Westerns and the tradition of samurai movies and all the, like, if you follow Brian Young on Twitter, he knows way more about it than I do. But the idea of sort of keeping the story going, I think, is kind of one of my favorite parts of it. And working alongside Ashley Eckstein, obviously, was fantastic. And she was tremendous in terms of helping me put things together.
She's pretty inspirational.
She's so great. I try not to be like, she's the best person ever, but she really kind of is. She really is.
What is, so when you guys are specifically creating something new in one of these franchises, what questions do you have to ask yourself in your respected areas to make that come about and then fit within whatever it is you're working with, if it's pre-existing or maybe it's just something that's a brand new movie and you're bringing it to life for the first time? What are those questions you have to ask?
Working on Clone Wars, it was kind of not easy, but I think the idea is that you know the film genres that your boss, George Lucas, loves. So if you create a bounty hunter and you pattern him after somebody from like a classic Western, like Lee Van Cleef from, you know, the Fistful of Dollars movies, then you realize like, oh, okay, you know, that's probably going to be approved. So, but that's also a character that feels right in the Star Wars universe. So we've heard of bounty hunters existing in that universe. So it's kind of like Tim was saying before about like, does this character belong in here? Are they just off screen? I just wanted to add something, by the way. I worked on Padme too. And Tim had said, like, oh yeah, which tool is she using? You know, diplomat or action? Just so you know, our very first meeting with George Lucas on Clone Wars, he's like, I want Padme to be like a diplomatic action heroine in the series. So you're like dead on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the tools that she was set up with, and that you want to take whatever you were given, as you guys have all said, and use that. One of the other considerations, along with does this character fit into, say, Star Wars, is to spend some time thinking, okay, how are all the other characters, the established characters, going to see them, to react to them, et cetera. One of the plot threads I was kind of hoping for at season four of Rebels, but I knew you didn't have time for it with everything else you had to wrap up, was Callus, and how the fact that some people in the rebellion would never, ever trust him. You just didn't, if you'd had a five or a fifth or a sixth season, you might have brought that in.
We wrote some of that stuff. It's on the, you know, on a cut and paste.
Yeah.
I never got it.
Because you just didn't have enough room for it. But how are people going to react to this character is one of the keys that helps define who the character is then.
The question, this isn't an exact answer to that question, but the way it was phrased reminded me of something that happened to me a while ago. Working on Doctor Who, there was a new design came in, new character. There was a drawing, looked kind of familiar. A guy with a winged helmet. I thought, I've seen that before. That's the helmet of invisibility from Clash of the Titans that was the inspiration for that drawing. Now, I know that helmet was made by one of the first guys in the UK to use fiberglass for props. He did like the very early Cybermen, Doctor Who. And I know that when he retired, I bought a load of molds from him. And I had the mold for the exact helmet that the designer had chosen as inspiration for the new design. So I could just fiberglass one out of the new mold. There we go, job done.
For us, if we're doing a new design, we have an art department, plus we have our fabrication shops, and I've always bounced between those two departments at most companies, we'll start with thumbnail sketches. We'll usually talk to the director or whoever's handling characters for the show, and then we'll start with thumbnail sketches. We'll have the director pick their favorite features from the thumbnail sketches, and then we'll do more refined drawings, and then maybe two more rounds of the refined drawings, and then we'll actually get into either making maquettes or actually fabricating for the character. And sometimes it'll go straight into the computer to create the character, and sometimes we'll design it for physical space where we all live.
We do. This is the first stuff I've ever worked on where I got to create non-human characters, which was exciting. And for specifically the Inquisitor from the Ahsoka book, when I was describing him, I was really describing him as like not the ones we've seen in Rebels. So every time I was trying to come up with like ways to describe what he looked like, I was like looking at the ones from Rebels and being like, okay, not that. And then he shows up in the Darth Vader comic, mm-hmm. and someone messaged me on Twitter and they were like, look, it's your Inquisitor. And he was perfect. And that was kind of like, for me, it was a huge moment because it was the first time I'd ever seen one of my characters imagined in like a different medium from the one that I'd written, which was cool.
Is there anything, working in Star Wars, all of you have gotten a chance to do that. So is there anything special that you guys have to think about when working in that universe? Are there any, you know, rules where you're like, we can't go that far, that breaks it. Is there anything that you have to have in your mind when you're creating a Star Wars character? Is it pretty much anything goes?
Most of the time we tried to stay away, just kind of a general rule was not to make the characters like superheroes. So someone couldn't fly unless they had wings and it made sense for them to have wings. So you don't get a lot of superhero-y kind of things going on. You know, it really comes down to kind of like Paul was saying about purpose. What's the purpose of the character in the story, especially if it's an ancillary character or a secondary character? And then wherever you can, as you were saying, try to actually create some visual that represents or symbolizes who they are as a character. And then, you know, obviously a lot can be done with sound, the way their voices or the noises they make. So with Star Wars, George gave us the freedom of anything goes. You know, he'd take, you know, a monster design and turn its head upside down and go, oh yeah, do that instead.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of internal consistency. There are any number of things you could do that would not be Star Wars. I think at some point you've just got a sense of what it is and you know, okay, that won't work. What you were saying is good. You want to kind of limit your Jedi as much as possible. You want to limit the power of any given side. I think they call it game balance in the gaming industry. So no side can overwhelm the other too easily. But it's just a sense of when I'm writing out an outline or something or a book, that's not Star Wars. This is Star Wars, and just going with that.
So that's a great question. How do you figure that out? Because is it just this innate sense of like, okay, that's not Star Wars, and that this is? Because it almost seems like that's ineffable, but we all know what that is.
You have to search your feelings.
For me, it was 19 times watching the original movie and however many times later on the other movies and such. It's kind of a feel. I don't know what about art, but I know what I like type of thing. And for me, it's just a sense of what I think Star Wars should be and what it is. And it's not the same as other people's view necessarily.
I think from the costume side of things, it was just trying to make sure that everything looked like it came from a used universe, so it all had a past history. I guess Amidala was a bit of an exception to that rule because of her status, but mostly it was just making sure it lived in a used universe.
Yeah, actually in the prequels, the reason things were cleaner in the prequels, George had described it as the universe was a much nicer place before the Empire took over. So things were cleaner in the prequels than they were, and they got dirtier kind of as we got closer to New Hope. That was very much part of the aesthetic for Star Wars, but also everything in Star Wars they had to fit into the confines of being inspired by something in our world. George always wanted to have something familiar about the character, something familiar about the guns and the, you know, so you could see inspiration drawn from all different cultures around the world, different points in history. And there were some rules that he would later decide to break. Like there were no wheels in Star Wars. That was a thing. And then we saw wheels in Revenge of the Sith, finally. But there were definitely rules having to do with just drawing from reality. Like with the creatures, they were all inspired by some actual creature, like the anatomy, the musculature, and all that kind of stuff. And the same went for characters, environments, and all of that. And I just wanted to add, I also worked with Padme, but not the character. I was the supervisor for her apartment in miniature.
So we have a Padme.
I feel like I have some follow-up questions for you. I guess everyone pretty much said it perfectly, and for me it is legit, like, search your feelings, and that's how you know if it's Star Wars. And sometimes I find I'll read something and be like, I never would have thought of that, and then I'll talk about it with another fan or someone else and it will be totally Star Wars for them, and as they explain it to me with like animated hand gestures and like all that kind of stuff, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I get it now. And I really like that kind of community based as sort of analysis as well.
I have to throw in just a comment. You were talking about Amidala's outfits. In Alliances, I've got a scene where Padme is changing outfits to head off and do something. I got a note back. I think it was Jennifer Heddle said, "This is Padme. Can we get some description?"
I mean, that's really important.
Yeah.
You got to get the outfit just right. Icon is a tough thing, and all of you have worked on icons. So what do you think it takes to create an icon in these different franchises? I mean, from Doctor Who, where you have over 50 years of history, Star Wars is now 40, and then, Henry, working on every single franchise under the sun in animation. I mean, what does it take then to create an icon in one of these franchises and have it stand next to, standing next to, what is that? How do you do that?
I think I approach a lot of my storytelling from the kind of Joseph Campbell mythic. So I really kind of try to hone in on an archetype. Obviously, Luke's, the coming of age story, and we obviously get that with Anakin too. But you can see that in Peter Parker too. And when you talk about stories, you know, Vader story about someone who's tempted to go down the dark side, didn't mean to, but turned to the dark side. I think everybody has struggled with that. So iconic, I think, always is, in my mind, something into the character that we actually relate to on a deep primal level. And then how it's represented visually, I think, is the psychology of it, you could say. So for me, it's how does this character relate to not just me, the person writing it, but to everybody out there who's going to read the story or see the story visually. But I defer to, at least for the visual medium, that's the way I go about trying to create a character or actually dealing with the character who is iconic. And I think it's funny you say iconic, because I think that actually has been a really hot point just recently with a lot of people, how they feel about Luke Skywalker and who he is, and then who he was treated, how he was, treated in the latest movie. Was a lot of people went, wait a minute, that's not the iconic character I know. So that's kind of a great question.
Yeah, I agree with what Henry said, but I would also say that we create characters we hope will resonate. Whether they become icons is up to you guys. We don't set out, okay, I'm going to make a character that's going to last in the public awareness for 40 years. We have no idea. We're just doing the best characters we can, the ones that that resonate with us and hope will resonate with you guys. You get to choose who gets icon status and who doesn't.
Yeah, I think a huge amount of it comes from the writing to start with. If you haven't got that, then you haven't got the character. And also you've got to factor in the performance of the actor as well, and hopefully having some kind of visual that backs both of those things up in a original way, really.
Yeah, on the design side, we do actually think about icons, but probably in a much different way than in writing, of course, because we're not describing the character through story, we're describing it visually. So, of course, we always think about what can we do to forward the story that's being told by the writer as a director. But also when we're in that thumbnail stage that I was talking about earlier, we do look for, that's one of the things you look at when you're doing thumbnails, is what are those iconic shapes?
Yeah.
You know, and you try to look at that shape and go, is that iconic or is it just kind of a squiggle? You know, you do look for shapes that define the character, you know, so there's a lot of that.
Yeah, like George always saying, you know, he wanted you to see in silhouette. You knew what ship that was. You knew what part of that was a good side ship, was a bad side ship. You knew from the shape that you had. So,
I think for me, it's basically what Tim said, that moment of connection with the audience. And there has been quite a bit of that in Star Wars, but I think the one that I saw and I was like, oh my God, I want to do that someday, was the moment in Solo when Enfys Nest took her helmet off.
Yes.
And it was like, because it was just so unexpected and so wonderful. And there's one wandering around. She's absolutely gorgeous if you find her.
Awesome.
She's so good. And just that moment where I was like, well done, everyone who was part of this, because it was a secret and it was wonderful. And like, it will be seared into my heart forever. And even if she's just iconic to me, like, that's the other thing, too. Like, there's a lot of characters who are going to be iconic to really specific people. And that's something that I think we can sort of expand going forward.
I think then the main answer for you guys is that you have to create a story first that matters, that people are going to resonate with. That's the most important part. You know, if it's, there's no story there, nobody's going to care what the design of something was in the end. You know, and what creates an icon is something that touches the soul of human being, and that comes from something like the hero's journey, you know, because it's ingrained in all of us from, you know, eons of history now. So I would love to hear from the different perspectives as you are in your specific areas working on these icons. What are the different things that you get to then add to the icon from, you know, whether it's visual effects, whether it's creating a costume? How is your part of the process? How does that add to what we see, you know, on screen?
I could use Ahsoka as an example. We were creating,
I mean, please do.
We created Ahsoka from kind of the very initial point of view, was to actually make the series about her and her journey through the Clone Wars, because we know what happens to Mace and we know what happens to Anakin and Obi-Wan. So, but what we don't know is her journey and how she grows up during this time of war. And I think that's just having a young person grow up in a time of war and having all these experiences away from the temple, I think was a really interesting exploration for me as a person, going like, gosh, how would I feel if I had to grow up during a time of war? So that, I think, was a really powerful reason to investigate and do research about what happens when people, you know, grow up in a time of hardship like that. So that's something I felt that it kind of helped me grow as a person.
The other nice thing about adding in a character like Ahsoka is you don't know if she will survive. That adds a little tension to it. You know Anakin gets through this okay in Padme, but you don't know about Ahsoka. So adding the new characters that you don't know their end point adds to the tension and the interest and such. I will just mention one little thing I got to do in Alliances. I was told that Vader kind of pushes the Anakin past away from him. He does not really acknowledge it. So one of the things we came up with was when Vader's remembering something that happened to Anakin, it's not, I remember this. It's the Jedi did that. Distancing himself, which I thought makes a nice, also nice little extra addition to the title, Return of the Jedi. So little things like that. And I get, of course, get the advantage, and the comic books get the advantage. We can get inside the character's mind where you don't really get to do that in a visual medium.
With my side of things, it's not quite as open to creative interpretation. Usually I've got quite strict guidelines to follow, but it's just trying to make something as believable as possible and give it a history, put little details on. For example, I did some helmets for the Doctor Who 50th anniversary show for soldiers, and it was just little things like making them look like there were clips that you could attach a gas mask to, or you could put a little helmet-mounted camera on. You don't ever see that. We didn't build a gas mask or a camera, but it's just trying to put on little details that add to the overall believability, really.
Pockets. Star Trek has forgotten about pockets.
In bathrooms. for us, I mean, because we do have an art department, we get to design stuff. If we're on one of the bigger movies, they have much bigger art departments, and a lot of times we just kind of add to the designs that have already been created by very talented people like Doug Chang. And one of my favorite things when we were working at ILM was to get a drawing for one of the Star Wars characters or environments or whatever, and it's just one piece of artwork that just shows one view, and they go, and you can just make up the rest. So it's just great because we're building a model or a costume or a character in 360 degrees, and we have an artwork that just shows one side. So we get to take that and use that for inspiration to create the whole rest of the art. So it's a lot of fun that way.
So in 1999, I went to see a movie, and it was called The Phantom Menace. And there was this awesome girl gang in it, and they kind of didn't show up again with a lot of lines in the future, although they do different versions of The Handmaidens come back. And so when the opportunity came up to sort of go into them a little bit more, I was like, yes, thank you. I will take all of them. Put them in my book. I am not a huge fan of group scenes because, like, mass conversations are deeply terrifying to me. Because when you're reading them, they're difficult to, like, make sure you know where everybody in the room is, even if they're not talking. And in this book, I was like, I'm just going to do it. Because I was so excited to sort of expand on this, like, fantastic group of girls that we don't know that much about yet.
Can I ask the one thought? I was just going to ask you, you said you, like, built a model for Padme's apartment. Did you do the bathroom?
There is no bathroom in Padme's apartment.
So it's just like Star Trek. That's what
they have to, yeah. They have to go downstairs.
Bathroom, please.
I can't even imagine going to the bathroom in those dresses, too.
It's new space food. They don't.
Nobody produces me.
She's a queen. She does not use the bathroom.
It really isn't that new panel. Which kind of brings me to this question. For all the iconic characters that you have gotten to work on, what is your favorite? And what was the thing that you got to add to them that just, you know, I mean, like EK, just Fangirl. You just were so excited that you got to be a part of that.
Somebody else want to start?
I have to think. I really enjoyed writing Bail Organa. He was fantastic. And there was a scene in the Ahsoka book that I tried not to be like indulgent and put in things that like fan me would want to see. I tried to like keep it a little bit professional. But there's the fish tank scene in Ahsoka, which was entirely for myself. And when I got to keep it, I was like, yes, because that's the scene with Leia. So it was really fun to sort of get to write that tiny, tiny snippet and then keep it.
I think probably reimagining what Judge Dredd looked like for the movie. And the real thrill after that is seeing that look go back into the comics and see how that what we did in the movie has re-informed the way some of the comic books are illustrated. And being able to have a bit of input in moving away from the very kind of high gloss, polished gold look of the Stallone movie that had gone before, and just take it all into a much more kind of believable, hopefully more kind of gritty direction.
For me, it was really interesting because when I grew up on Star Wars, I was a huge fan of Star Wars, and then when I finally got to work on it, it was more exciting to work on the characters that were established when I was a child than newer characters. Just because there was that nostalgia involved, you know. But the funnest thing about creating new things is they made toys of everything. So you might grab a little detail-y bit off the table and glue it onto a robot, and then that you'll see that same thing miniaturized on the toy. Like, that's that thing I found on the table.
I would tell everyone forever.
I was just going to say that's a really good point. Seeing the toy come out of something that you've worked on is always really exciting.
Thrawn, everything. actually, probably the biggest challenge, I talked earlier about how people react. The biggest challenge in alliances is having Vader and Anakin and Padme and Thrawn and seeing how they will react, all of them, to this character. Because they're different points of view, different goals, different motivations, different constraints. How are they going to deal with him? And that's a lot of fun to be able to expand those characters a little bit.
I definitely can see that for Tim Zahn, Thrawn, Tim Zahn.
No relation. do you want to know where Thrawn comes from? You know where Thrawn comes from, right?
No, I don't think you've ever told me.
When I was first creating the character, I thought since he's the only alien in the higher echelons, he might have developed a certain amount of neuroses and such. I gave away that idea very quickly and put all that crazy stuff on the clone Sabaoth instead. But by that time I had chosen the name for the character, which is the Scottish word for twisted. So Thrawn is twisted, does not rhyme with my name, and is not at all related to it.
Probably the iconic characters were really being able to develop Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker in the Clone Wars. Mm-hmm. And I think to really show, here's how these characters, the last time you see them in Attack of the Clones, how they became who they are in Revenge of the Sith. So that was a really great exploration to say, hey, here's what happens when you have these two noble characters who go to war. One of them really does is affected more than the other, and how they would react differently. So that was something in my mind was something that we wanted to really build into the series to show the evolution of these characters. Maybe we know they survived, but we don't know how they got from point A to point B.
And that was very effective and very much appreciated because it would seem such a jolt in the movies, but you got to fill in all of that and make it feel much more reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, you get to the end, you know, in Revenge of the Sith now, and the hero completely turns into the villain, and you're like, what? But you had like 7 seasons of being amazing, and now you're this. Why? You know, and it really does. It changes that. And I think that's something that's so interesting. And so it brings me a question for you guys. And then after this question, if you guys want to ask questions, just come over here and I'll give you the mic because we don't have another one. But do you prefer to work on legacy characters, or do you prefer to create your own, and why? I get paid nothing to ask these hard questions.
Yeah. Actually, they're both fun to work with. I like being able to develop added things to the characters or just expand on what's already been shown in the movies or the TV shows. But it's fun to bring your own characters in to play in George's sandbox and such as well. So I would say the answer is yes for both of those.
I like expanding on characters that we already know. So if they're sort of like a minor character or someone from the background who doesn't have quite as much of a backstory as Anakin or Obi-Wan, and to sort of dig into them a little bit. And because everyone has a name, which is one of my favorite things about Star Wars. Like when you flip through those Pablo Hidalgo's illustrated guides to whatever, they all have names. And I'm just like, I want to know everything about them. And sometimes they pay me to write it.
Yeah, let's see. My favorite actually out of everything that I had done on the series in 10 years was R2-D2. It was always R2-D2. I don't know why. I think part of it is... I like robots a lot, but no, I think part of it is when you're working with R2-D2, that is R2-D2. Mm-hmm. You know, you very rarely see, the actor inside for some scenes. So all the other characters really rely on seeing the actor, so you don't feel like you're with that character. But when you're with R2-D2, you're with R2-D2, especially the robotic ones, because he's a robot. There's something really kind of fun about that.
Even the people who build them and bring them to conventions, like there's always like a trailing line of kids behind them. Yeah. Like, oh my God, it's
okay to do. I agree. It's good to do both, to kind of recreate old characters and reimagine them and to do new ones. But from my personal perspective, what I had a lot of fun doing was I got to reimagine the look of the Time Lords for the 50th anniversary Doctor Who. And I tried to do that in a way that honored all the previous versions that have gone before, and just put loads of little subtle details in there and use some of the shapes and silhouettes, but just bring them up to date in a more HD TV friendly kind of way.
But on a related note, so when you're designing these new looks for the characters, do you take cosplay into considerations? I know I've heard jokes about David Bowie going, let's see the cosplayers do this one. is that something you guys take into consideration? Is it, what is it like when you also see then those designs brought to life as someone not on screen?
I wouldn't say we think about cosplay specifically, but we do think about practicality of someone wearing a costume. And you know, being on a stage for 12 hours a day, that's I would say actually our considerations in a way though are much easier than cosplayers, because they'll wear something around a crowd for an entire weekend. We only have to last usually that 12-hour day, and then we can repair it. I don't know, it's different. But we do think about comfort, we do think about mobility for most things. There's that practical side to the designs.
I'd say for the most part, we're not really thinking about what the cosplayers are going to do when we're creating a character or a costume. But I have to say, there was a little element of that in Dredd, where I didn't want there to be the possibility that the fans could find a commercially available set of leather motorcycle trousers or jacket, because I know how quickly they would all spot that. So I made sure that everything was absolutely scratch built on that. The irony then being, I helped some of the cosplay guys with information. I kind of shot myself.
So before I ask the question, I do want to say thank you to all of you for all you've done on Star Wars. I love Rex, I love Thrawn. Extremely impressed with Padme's hairstyle. Part of the reason why I became a drummer. I love R2-D2 and I love the scene of the fish tank.
Thanks.
So because I love the baby Leia and I love how Bail Organa pretty much cursed that R2-D2 one droid. But anyway, so
If I'm correct, Mr. Zahn, you were the one technically brought the 501st into the Star Wars world, correct?
Yes, in Survivor's Quest.
Okay, so my question is for both you and Mr. Gilroy, what did you guys go through to create a 501st? Like, because I know Mr. Gilroy, you created clone troopers in Italian, and Mr. Zahn, you're the one
actually, the 501st was created by, and I've lost his name, somebody, Alban Johnson, 15 odd years ago or something like that? The 20th, okay. Now, can't possibly have been 20 years.
You should be on the panel.
Yeah. As a Star Wars costuming group, we just kind of picked that up and ran with it. At least I did. You had to do both.
Yeah, on Clone Wars, I think it really came out of the necessity where the Senate had created this army of clones that were, for all intents and purposes, just cannon fodder. And the Jedi really came along and started giving them names beyond just their numbers and really making them feel like people. Because the Jedi are empathic and care about other living creatures. So that was, I think, the beginning of the personality of like, oh, hey, these guys should actually have color delineations that actually identifies who they are and who they're with. And that's why later on, once, you know, the Order 66 happens, you know, the Emperor basically says, yeah, wipe all that individualism out. We don't care. Just put them in white suits of armor. So really, I think the creation is really about the clones taking on some of the personality of the Jedi that followed. And that's something that you see in the comics, and I think they developed in Clone Wars as well as other media.
I think that's one of the things that I loved about that series is that you see the way in which the Jedi can influence the universe for good, and they do by giving that army, which is made to be destroyed, humanity. And the pain, again, of watching Order 66 when they turn on their masters because they have no choice. Then the beauty of seeing somebody like, some of those clones not do that. You know, there's such humanity in that, and I think that's something that's really cool about the Clone Wars.
This is a question specifically for DK, but I guess probably for old men. As far as setting, that's the one thing that's setting in so good is almost its own character. It's very close, small screen, very intimate experience. I felt that it actually put Ahsoka into a pressure cooker, and she may have been a different person. She might have been a galaxy-wide experience. And I was wondering if you might speak to that as far as like how the setting maybe is defined as a character or even
is influencing
your character.
Okay, that's a great question. So with Rada specifically, which is the farming planet, moon, something, I forget. It's a moon. It was very much the idea of going to ground. Like literally she goes to a farming planet. And her isolation, she's trying to stay as alone as possible because she has this idea that everywhere she goes, she's going to attract attention. Which is, of course, what happens. And so I basically she keeps trying to isolate herself, trying to find smaller and smaller, more out-of-the-way planets. And no matter what happens, she keeps sort of getting drawn back into the events. And eventually she starts reaching out to more people and forming bonds with people like she used to do before all her friends were murdered by her other friends. And so it was that idea of sort of really, really isolating her. And sort of keeping her, she makes her own decisions in a way that she's never done before because she doesn't have any backup ever coming. They said I could write Ahsoka and that was it. She was the only character that I was able to write into the book. Now we know why. But I think that it really served the story really, really well to have her not be able to call Rex if she needs him, not be able to call Hondo. Like, she can call nobody. And putting her on a farm in the middle of nowhere was the sort of galactic equivalent of what was going on inside.
So this is for BK, this was on. Say Lucasfilms called you one day and said, okay, we're going to give you free reign to do any story you like Old Republic, any character, new group, what would you choose?
I have three proposals ready to pitch to them right now.
I also have several.
Yeah. If they said no Thrawn, then I probably would pitch the idea. I've always assumed that when after Obi-Wan dropped Luke off on Tatooine, that he went a good distance away and started making an absolutely loud, noisy nuisance of himself to draw attention that direction while the trail to Tatooine went cold. I would like to do a book of Obi-Wan making a nuisance of himself.
That seems like a good idea for a movie as well.
Do we know anybody at Lucasfilm?
I don't know. I mean, we might be able to come up with someone. I had like a standard answer for this. And then in the middle of New York Comic Con panel last year, Pablo asked the same question, except it had to be a villain. And I can't remember what my original prepared answer was going to be, but halfway through the person's next to me answer, I was like, oh my God, I just had the greatest idea ever. I don't know how it would work or what the practicalities of it would be, but I would love to write a YA Palpatine. I just think it would be fun. It's like a lot of art appreciation and convincing your friends to murder their dogs and then feel bad about it.
This one for Mr. Zahn. At Thrawn Alliance, I was telling my friend about how I love the dynamics of Vader and Thrawn Alliance, and how like Thrawn kind of put Vader in his place with his logic. And one of the things my friend was like, well, doesn't that kind of break Vader's character? Like, he doesn't cut for anybody. But I was like, well, I mean, in my opinion, like, Vader constantly said, well, Vampire trusts Thrawn. And to me, that was like his way of still letting Thrawn kind of ask the questions and give him the logic. And Vader respected him for that. I was wondering, did you ever get any like comments about that or any like hesitation in writing the relationship with each other?
There was some question from some people about certain scenes. You know, Vader would crush him like a bug at this point. And I had to point out, okay, first of all, the Emperor still has use for Thrawn. Vader will hold off. I mean, pretty much nobody has use for Admiral Ozzel anymore, so we can croak him. But Thrawn is still useful, so that's going to help hold back Vader. But to help with that all, I put in a couple of places of Vader is curious. Okay, what is Thrawn going to pull out of his hat this time? And having, because we've got the parallel stories and the Jedi had seen Thrawn do similar things, I think curiosity will be almost as strong as this is the Emperor's servant. I can't just kill him. Just Vader is, I mean, he was Anakin. He was clever. He was smart. He was a good combat person. He knew tactics and strategy. Okay, this is a different guy. I don't necessarily like or trust him, but I want to see what he's coming up with this time. I think it is within character, and I didn't get any complaints from Lucasfilm after that, once I'd kind of, this is how I see it.
What are the challenges with that situation, like in Star Wars? We have so many characters that don't have a backstory, and then you guys are coming up with a backstory. The other question I have is, Tim, I'm not going to be here for your signing, and my bartender, I promise my bartender, is there an offering time I can do this with you?
Yeah, I can sign it. I did have one person comment, and I'd never even thought about this. They thank you for setting up the Thrawn and Vader walk into a bar.
The Disney bar.
I actually think that's the name of the review episode for the 602 Club. Just in a Jedi walk into a bar.
You want personalized?
Jeremy.
I think that's one of my favorite, like, things about Star Wars is that there's always going to be someone around to tell that story. So a lot of us got to do it for the Certain Point of View anthology, which are characters that, you know, you see in the bar on Tatooine, or people who are handing Tarkin stuff, or like that kind of thing, or like people you hear on the radio. I think that's Adam Christopher's, the person who is on the other end of the radio when Han calls in. And it's like, they're like, we have a prison? Because they don't know what's going on the Death Star. So like, there's a princess? What is happening? And so I just love that sort of the way of opening windows. And we get to do that so frequently. And I think From a Certain Point of View is probably my favorite example of that, just because it's things that like one person never could have thought of, but 40 people plus, I guess it's like 44 plus Elizabeth, our fantastic editor, did, which was amazing.
There was an experience in there. I think I was on, after I finished my work on Clone Wars season 1 and 2, one called me at like on a Saturday afternoon in 2009 and said, so George wants to bring back Darth Maul. And he needs to write a comic book story for how that happens, how he survives. And I'm like, what do you mean how he survives? George put in a scene so you see both sides of him to make sure the fans knew he was dead.
Well, he's not
you
dead.
You can't change your mind, George.
He was just cut in half.
He got better.
It's just a mere flesh.
So that was probably one of those experiences where it's like, okay, this is awesome. On the other hand, it's like, what? And you have 8 pages to do it. So because they don't want to give too much detail into, you know, what we actually are going to see in a year and a half when he appears on the screen. So I think it's awesome when you have an opportunity to bring a character like that back, or to like EK was saying about expand on where they were and where they've gone, where they're going to.
Did you suggest this was Maul's twin brother?
He had a brother. They were even writing something about his brother. I was thinking instead of like, you can have a character named Tzan. Louis Thrawn's twin brother. That's one of your proposals, isn't it?
I'm not allowed to say.
I do have a quick question for you guys. Is there any iconic character that you just haven't gotten to work on? I mean, Henry, you've worked them all, but I mean, is there any iconic character you think, man, I would love the opportunity to do something with this character or design something for this character?
I would really like to work on My Little Pony Friendship is Magic.
Very iconic. I can make that happen.
Okay, thank you.
I actually have a funny, great story. Last convention, someone asked, is there a franchise that I never got to work on? And I always say the same, too. Tron, I would love to do anything in the world of Tron, because I think it's beautiful. And then Godzilla. And then I got, like 4 days after that convention, I got a call from the producers of Godzilla. And I got to work on the last Godzilla.
Awesome.
Movie. So
awesome.
Now it's just Tron.
Clock starts now.
Yeah, I guess I'd probably like to have a go at reimagining some of the old classic Doctor Who monsters from the 70s, or maybe even ones that have been done more recently, like have another redesign of the Cybermen or something like that.
I would like to do something with Doctor Who, but I've been told that they're keeping this for British authors. You know, so the way it was explained, you got to have a British passport in order to write Doctor Who. So it's kind of, unless I emigrate, that's probably out of the question. However, I figure it's only a matter of time before Disney buys the BBC. And then I'm in.
So he's been stalking me on the panel.
Once again, I've always had the panels before you, and I'm aware that I cannot use that joke at a Doctor Who panel. Yeah. So anyways, this one is for you and Mr. Zahn again. And this one is more of a lore one, it's just more to lore, but like, so I'm trying to figure out, like, does Zahn know that Rex is a rebel? Because in that episode, like, they're trying to bust Callus out before he's discovered. When Kane does the mind trick, they instantly get discovered, and Rex ends up getting into a fist fight with
price. So does like that mean that Lon knew that like Kanan and Rex were going to be boarding this ship and that they would be using like Rex's codes to board the ship and his audio right to them?
Rex, who is it? Ezra. So yeah, Rex is in a stormtrooper outfit. He in disguise. So no, Thrawn doesn't know who's in the armor. Does that answer your question? So Thrawn isn't aware of it. He figures it out from the art clues later on.
It was Ezra.
Ezra.
Thank you.